Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Tom DeFrank with the National Journal. Joining me on the show this week are Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C., and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. The long-simmering controversy over alleged contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government last year to help Donald Trump become president has escalated. There are new disclosures that Donald Trump Jr. and two senior campaign officials met last summer with a Russian lawyer with connections to individuals close to the Russian government. In the Middle East, the Iraqi prime minister declared that government forces have recaptured the city of Mosul, claiming that the fight against ISIS in Iraq has finally been won. Simultaneously, the ceasefire in southwest Syria, brokered by President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Hamburg G20 summit, remained in force. Back in Washington, Senate Republicans shortened their annual summer vacation by 2 weeks and unveiled a new version of a bill to replace and repeal the country's existing health care law, commonly known as Obamacare. It was unclear whether the Republican 2.0's version would sufficiently thread the needle between Republican conservatives and moderates who believe the first version gave too many tax breaks to wealthy Americans to get a bill passed. The intense political battle over health care in the United States ironically overshadowed the plight of a critically ill 11-month-old British infant whose plight has been cited by Pope Francis and President Trump. His parents want to bring him to the United States for treatment, but under British health laws, that decision is controlled by the government, not his parents. Well, we've got a lot to talk about, my colleagues, so let's get right to it. Let's talk about the escalating situation involving emails and alleged Russian collusion denied by the White House between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. New developments. In June of last year, shortly after candidate Trump had secured the Republican presidential nomination, a business associate emailed Trump Jr. saying the Russian government was offering to provide, quote, some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father, unquote. The information was advertised as, quote, part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump, end of quote. Trump Jr. replied the same day, if it's what you say, I love it. A meeting was arranged with a Russian lawyer a few days later in Trump Tower. The legal problem and the legal implications, we have a long way to go on figuring that out, but there is a political problem, Michael. Political problem, I would suggest, is that these emails dramatically contradict months of denial that anyone in the Trump campaign had sought Russian help from the Russian government. Trump officials have repeatedly denied that any such meetings took place. In the past, Trump Jr. called such allegations disgusting and big lies. And President Trump continues to call these allegations, quote, the greatest witch hunt in American history. Now, after made aware that journalists had copies of these new emails, Trump Jr. changed his tune. He first said the meeting focused largely on adoption policies between the U.S. and Russia. A day later, after it was clear the New York Times knew the real story, he said the meeting had been arranged to discuss the Russian offer to provide damaging information on Hillary Rodham Clinton. There is now a new development. At the end of the week, there was apparently a fifth person in the room with this meeting with Donald Trump Jr., the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and campaign advisor Paul Manafort, and a Russian-American lobbyist with ties to Russian and Soviet intelligence. He was not mentioned in any of the previous disclosures from the White House and the Trump campaign. So, Michael, it's a lot to digest. Why is this such a problem now for the Trump administration, and has it gotten worse now?
It's been a problem right the way through because of the unclarity of it all and because of the drip, drip, drip of it all. The connections between the Trump family and their business dealings and Russia are quite clear. And had they really just come out and made it very clear that we have those connections and, you know, we are not going to do anything with them in politics, I think everything would have been fine because there was no law against them doing what they were doing. But the fact that they're showing this, not only are they making mistakes, I think, just clearly making mistakes, and you could call them rookie mistakes. Paul Manafort is no rookie, by the way, but so he's not making rookie mistakes. But to take this meeting is a clear mistake. You know, it's a wrong thing to do. No one with any political savvy at all would have taken that meeting. If they had taken the meeting, as soon as it was over, you call the FBI. I think everyone with any sense knows that and has done that. Now, is it a problem for them? Yes, it is. It is a problem politically, to some sense, to his base, no, it's not a problem. They're going to explain it away and say that, well, he made a mistake, and Donald Sr., the president, has already said, well, Don Jr., he's a good kid, 39 years old, but he's a good kid, and he didn't mean to do anything, and there was nothing wrong with the meeting. The 38% that backs Donald Trump is going to be just fine with it. I think that Donald Trump Jr. does not have a problem. I think Jared Kushner has a problem, because he's the one who has changed this disclosure on his statements. He, in effect, lied on a federal disclosure form for security clearance, which is a felony. So that's going to be a problem. And now you have this fifth person in the room, as yet unnamed. Again, the only things that come out are the things that are reported out by the media, the dreaded, hated media. Without them, we probably wouldn't even know about the meeting and certainly wouldn't know what happened in it.
Oren, what is your take on all of this?
What's significant about this meeting and the emails that have been revealed by Donald Trump Jr. is that they show a willingness by the Trump campaign to work with the Russians and to receive information from the Russians, and from somebody who was not necessarily a government lawyer, but was described to them as, you know, representative of the Russian government. And there's U.S. law prohibits receiving anything of value from foreign nationals that would help a political campaign. So that's, you know, apart from the disclosure issues, that's a second legal kind of hook for prosecutors to hang of possible charges. You know, the other thing is that the other part that's interesting about this, I think, is that Donald Trump, the president, is saying that this lawyer was, you know, a private lawyer, not a Russian government lawyer, trying to make this distinction about who exactly she, you know, whether she was actually working for the government, whether she was actually the government of Russia. And he described this meeting as very standard in politics, that everybody in politics uses opposition research, and that it's normal to meet with people with damaging information about your opponent. And these two statements that he made sort of tie into two key parts of this controversy. One of them is that all the allegations about possible collusion and whether the Trump campaign was working with, you know, with information that was provided by Russian intelligence, all of it relies on a lot of layers of intermediaries. And when Donald Trump describes this woman is not the Russian government, he's basically relying on these layers of intermediaries that they've been working through, or apparently have been working through. And the other part is that he has this sense that all of this is normal, that the system is corrupt anyhow, and that to do these kinds of things is just normal part of doing business in politics.
That speaks to the naivete of some of those around the president who pride themselves on a lack of government experience, and sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. We'll see how it sorts out. To me, I think there are two fundamental problems with this new information. One, there is now, for the first time, a paper trail provided by the president's son confirming what Trump partisans have steadfastly denied for months, that the Trump campaign was open to at least hearing dirt on Hillary Clinton offered up by the Russian government. They were willing to take a meeting after being told that the alleged dirt was being offered up by the Russian government. That's a problem. The other one is just a more fundamental one. I've been here a long time. Some of my friends say maybe you've been here too long, but one of the things I've learned in damage control in Washington is a cardinal precept of damage control is, if you have nothing to hide, don't behave like you do.
Right.
And here we have campaign officials, children of the president, administration officials constantly changing their stories because they've forgotten to put down the names of some meeting with a Russian on their security clearance forms or some sworn testimony before Congress. And stories often change. All of that fuels the suspicion that maybe there is something to hide. I think the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, will decide whether any of this amounts to criminal behavior. And we probably won't know that answer for months. But at the very least, what a White House correspondent said in a briefing last week, describing an awful lot of amnesia, a plague of amnesia, he called it, at the White House, raises doubts. And so we'll have to see where it goes. But at the very least, I think we would all agree on one thing, and that is that this is a distraction, for sure, a distraction from what the president and Republicans want to be talking about, which is the president's legislative and policy agenda. It's harder to do that when you're having to fight fires every day.
But it's a self-created distraction, by the way.
Well, exactly right. Exactly right. But there we have it. And the president, of course, is trying to change the subject and focus on his ambitious legislative agenda. And he now is wading into the debate about health care reform. So the president is trying to change the political focus to health care. The Senate Republicans tried to pass a health care bill before the 4th of July congressional recess. They didn't have the votes. They went home, they're back, and they're trying again. And they're hoping to do it again. Michael, what are the main differences between their first version and this one? It appears they've tried to move to the middle to placate some Republican moderates who think the first version was too draconian and too prone to help the wealthy at the expense of poor Americans.
So, in an effort to placate those on the moderate side and on the conservative side, they've cut out some of the taxes for the wealthy that were a problem for some of the moderates there. On the conservative side, they've added the ability for insurance companies that if they offer some policies that adhere to the constructs of what you have now in current law with the ACA, with Obamacare, you are able to offer these slimmer plans for the healthy, for the young, where you don't offer such comprehensive care, where you don't necessarily have things like maternity care or mental health, that sort of thing, these slimmed down packages. So you're able to offer smaller things to those who want them, offering quote-unquote choice. And that's an appeasement and an offering that was put into the bill by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. And I believe currently it's still in parentheses in writing on the bill, which is how fresh it is. I think the ink maybe is still wet on that one. Those are sort of the major differences. And there's some changes to the block grants that and how they work in terms of going to the states. And it's all very complicated and detailed and esoteric, so we won't even try to go into it that detailed a level. Well, but I will say the things that were still a problem, though, are the fact that you are slashing Medicaid in a very, very draconian way. And it's by and large, to that extent then, it is no different from the first.
Medicaid is the federal program helping lower income and needy Americans more, and it is a important to tens of millions of Americans. Now, we'll have a little bit more on health care in just a minute, but first, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Tom DeFrank, with the National Journal. Joining me on the show this week are Orrin Darrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor in Washington, D.C. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Now, Orrin, let's go back to health care for just a minute. President Trump is up the ante. He has basically said to the Republicans, you better do that. He said the other day, I will be very angry if this doesn't happen. I would have liked to have been in Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office when he saw the film clip of the president saying, I will be very angry if Senator McConnell doesn't do this. And Senator McConnell, who is a master of the inside legislative game, is pulling out some stops of his own. He's the one who canceled the traditional August vacation recess for the Senate by 2 weeks. And usually, as an old legislative guy said to me the other day, there is nothing that concentrates the mind of a legislator more than losing half of his vacation in August, which is not the most pleasant place to be in Washington summers. So anyway, Orrin, Michael is right. We shouldn't try to confuse our listeners with a detailed parsing of the new and perhaps improved health care bill. The real question is, do the Republicans in the Senate have the votes to pass this? At the moment, two Republican senators have said, no way. So the Republicans cannot lose a single Republican if they hope to get this passed. What are the prospects in the Senate now?
Well, they need 50 yes votes. And like you say, there's at least two people that have said no. There's two more people who have said maybe no or probably no. And meanwhile, Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana offered up a new plan to compete with this latest plan that would transfer the Obamacare tax money to the states to do with as they please. So I think it's still very much up in the air. You know, one of the problems, as Michael said, is that Congressional Budget Office says that 15 million Americans would lose Medicaid by 2026 if this plan goes forward. And if this plan goes forward and there are such drastic cuts to very popular programs, the Republicans will take, I think, a beating when it comes to the midterm elections. or at least they'll have to defend this when it comes to the midterm elections. So this, for them, I mean, this was a major campaign pledge of the president, a major campaign pledge of the people who supported him. And I guess we'll have to see what happens. If they don't achieve it, there'll be consequences. And if they do, there'll be consequences as
well. It's like many things. There are risks in everything. There are risks in doing nothing. There are risks in doing something. There's all kind of risks, no matter how it sorts out. If the vote were held today, this new version of health care would not pass the Senate. But there's at least another month for the Senate Majority Leader to twist arms, and the president can twist arms. Let's just see. But this is a true hot-button issue. Now,
I would add that there is talk about trying to do some kind of a negotiations that would include the Democrats,
but I think,
which would probably result in a much different outcome. But I don't know if it would have a better chance of succeeding.
Well, who knows? Because the Democrats have pressures on their left from Democrats who say there should be, you know, more generous benefits to people, not fewer benefits.
Universal health care is the ultimate goal of the left.
Yeah. In the personification of Senator Bernie Sanders, who's now saying, maybe I'll run for president in 2020. So there's all kind of countervailing pressures here. Now, I want to go back to foreign policy, but I don't want to do that until we talk just a little bit about the 11-month-old baby Charlie Gard, a British infant who has serious neurological problems. British courts have sided with his doctors, who say he is beyond repair. And the hospital treating young Charlie Gard is asked to remove him from life support. His parents are fighting that. And at the moment, this case is back in the courts. And Michael, there just seems to be something a little incongruous about a situation where, I'm not taking sides, of course, but where parents can't decide on what they think is best for their son. In this case, under the British system, the courts probably have the last word.
It seems so in their system. And it's President Trump has weighed in on behalf of the Gard family and the young infant who's suffering from this extremely rare condition. I think it's something to do with mitochondrial depletion syndrome, I think it is. Extremely rare, and supposedly there is a treatment here in the States where he could come and get that treatment, and in 3 months they'd know for sure whether it worked or not. And he's not being allowed to, the parents are not being allowed to come and bring him. It's turning out to be a cautionary tale for those on the right in the United States, for the pro-life lobby and that sort of thing, about the national health care system, the idea of universal health care run by the government. The idea is that here's the banner, here's what happens when you lose control of your own family decisions. Here's why we don't want this to happen here. That being said, there is nothing that precludes our system working anything like their system if you have universal health care, if you have government-run assistance. It's just a matter of drawing proper boundaries in those things.
Oren?
So apparently the way what the American doctor is offering to do for baby Charlie Gard is a treatment that he says would have an 11 to 56% chance of improved muscle strength and a, quote, small but significant, unquote, chance of improved brain function. And right now, what the doctors are saying who are treating him in Britain are saying that he is, you know, he's basically suffering from the ongoing treatment of what they're having to do to him, and that their responsibility is to do no harm and to not harm a patient when there's no point in doing so, not cause any suffering when there's no point in doing so. And that's what the judge is trying to weigh, is whether the benefit of sending the child to the States will outweigh the harm of ongoing treatment.
It just seems a little incongruous that you have a judge trying to decide what is the size of this infant's head, because that gives you some sense of the degree of damage, and apparently neither side can quite agree on what is the real size of his head. It's just the whole thing is incongruous, but whatever it is or whatever it isn't, it just is a very sad situation.
Indeed.
Now, in the last few minutes here, I want to turn back to geopolitics. I want to go back to Iraq, where after years of fighting ISIS, Iraqi military forces with a lot of support from United States military advisors have finally retaken the key city, the historic city of Mosul, and the Iraqi prime minister, quick to capitalize on the triumph, went to Mosul, toured what's left of Mosul, which is not very much. Sad to see some historic mosques, hundreds of years old, reduced to rubble. But he declared victory, and he said, ISIS is finished in our country. Oren, was that a little too, what someone once called irrational exuberance, or does he have a point? Is this the beginning of the end of ISIS, at least in Iraq?
Probably not. The Prime Minister Abadi gave his victory speech in the beginning of this week, and the fighting continues as we speak. The government has taken control of the city, and what they're still doing is probably considered mop-up operations. But this has turned from a battle against an entity, the Islamic State, that held territory and fought as an army, basically, to now they're able to perform an insurgency. And there's likelihood that there are elements that still support them and that they'll continue operating. But the question now is, what has changed in Western Iraq? What has changed in, politically, and what has changed in terms of how the central government governs the local areas? Because those questions are what led to local support for ISIS to begin with back in 2014. In 2014, when ISIS swept through the area and took control of Mosul, which is the second largest city of Iraq, the Sunni tribes got up and said, "This is a Sunni tribal revolution. It's not ISIS."
Exactly.
Right. And the question is whether the central government has learned its lessons and will give more power to the Sunnis. The central government is controlled by the Shia majority of Iraq, and whether there'll be more power sharing, more allocation of resources, more even allocation of resources, and how the ethnic and sectarian issues are dealt with at the central government level. The Iraqi officials are saying that they've learned their lessons from the past, but there have been images of Shiite militia flags flying from traditionally Sunni villages, and there have been complaints about, again, of uneven allocation of military resources to the people fighting on the ground. So we'll see what happens.
Well, with 1 minute to go, Oren, you're going to get the last word on another topic, which is Syria. President Trump and President Putin brokered a deal at the G20 summit for a ceasefire in the southwestern part of Syria, and at least at this moment it appears to be holding. Trump said this is a way we can have huge differences but also can join together to make things better. What are the prospects for this ceasefire in Syria holding and perhaps even expanding in Syria?
The government, the U.S. government is, and the Russian government are hoping to expand this ceasefire agreement. Right now, it's very localized to southwestern Syria. Doesn't include ISIS elements or Al Qaeda elements, and those groups can continue to be spoilers and sort of provoke the Syrian government and the Russians to respond to attack them and to attack them in areas where U.S. supported and Jordanian supported militias are operating. So we've seen these ceasefires in the past. They've failed in the past. And it's another one of these things where we're going to have to see how it plays out. The big question in Syria is whether the United States and Russia share the same strategic goals. And right now it seems as though the Russians still support Assad and the Americans still do not.
Well, as we say often, time will tell. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Joe Gill, and I'm Tom DeFrank with the National Journal. Thanks for listening.